All right, ladies, buckle up.
It's showtime. It's showtime.
It's showtime.
It's showtime.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Manet Talk. This is our 40th episode. I am your co-host, Julian Owens, and with me, as always,
Johnny Lightfoot.
Johnny, how are you doing on this marvelous Sunday afternoon?
I'm doing great. The Cowboys are just beating the crap out of the Rams, and yeah, it's a nice day. It was nice outside. It's been a nice weekend. I'm excited for today's topic.
Oh, you and I both. So, before we get into our topic, which will be the top 10 films of the decade, we'll talk about a little bit more on that. But before we get into that, Johnny, what were the numbers this past weekend?
All right, so we're recording a little earlier, so this is the preliminary numbers. This isn't set in stone, but it looks like this is how it's going to turn out. Coming in at number one, Jumanji, The Next Level, bringing in $60.1 million. No surprise there. Number two, Frozen 2 finally topples from the top spot, bringing in $19.1 million, bringing its domestic total to $366 million. Wow. Number three, Knives Out, bringing in another $9.2 million, bringing its domestic to $78.9 million. Number four, Richard Jewell in its first weekend, bringing in $5 million. And fifth, Black Christmas, bringing in $4.4 million.
Before we get into our topic, or before I talk about DVD release date, I just want to say something. We were going to discuss Black Christmas on this podcast.
If you remember,
we have both seen this film, and yeah, it was not worth the price of admission. I don't think so.
No, and my admission was like taxes, which was like a dollar or something.
$2 or $3, exactly.
And what's crazy is the trailers are okay, and I was like, the premise seemed all right. Like going in, this is just really quick, folks. Just venting really a little quick.
Vince, yes.
So. Premise seemed all right, and I was like, okay, all right. So these are like, this is why these people are coming after them. And then it just goes over the top, B movie, ridiculous. And I was like, how are you going to set your film up for the first hour as trying to be sort of grounded, trying to be serious, and then just go way over the top to the point where you're doing slow motion fight scenes and having characters doing these weird, ridiculous monologues that belong in B-movies of the 70s and 80s, which is fine. If you want to do that, sell the movie as that, and that first hour, you should have leaned into that, but you didn't. You tricked me. You were false. I was rolling my eyes the last 30 minutes.
To that point, I think calling it a B-movie is an understatement. I think you're being way too generous. In my personal opinion, this should have been like a Lifetime movie that literally was at late night premiere, like at 1 o'clock in the morning, that was just thrown in. Because as Johnny said, when you watch the trailer, you're feeling like, oh wow, this is, you know, a college murder movie. It's kind of gonna be bad. They're doing something because of what the girls are basically portraying or their message that they're trying to bring out. You're like,
which is cool. Fine. I'm right. All for the message, you know, anti-rape culture, like patriarchal society, all of
misogyny,
that stuff,
the
like,
whole nine,
yeah, all of that. I am your target male audience, right?
Specifically,
me,
right?
Me and all the ladies, we are your audience. Me and Julie, we're there with you. We are all for this, and you had me like the whole time. Like the one character who was fighting for the rights, I was like, yeah,
okay,
you do your thing, like
I
you
it.
Do your thing,
I dig her.
And then,
so to his point, one movie I will say that I was thinking it was going to lean more towards from last year was Assassination Nation.
Yes, which was good.
I was really hoping it was going to be like Assassination Nation. I'm like, wow, they're about to go stick it to the guys. They're going to fuck them up bad, and they're going to get what is coming to them. Literally, the girl who literally was basically saying, hey, this is our message. We want to get about anti-rape. We want to stop all this misogyny, the white power, the whole supremacy idea. Was the only enjoyable character in the entire film. Even the main protagonist, she seemed so, what's the word I'm looking for? So bland, so like nuanced. And then her her love interest, which just pissed me off. Sorry we're spoiling it, because I'm sorry, just venting right now. Was so bland too. He had some kind of glimmer of hope in the beginning, and then throughout the rest of the movie, you're just sitting there watching and just, wow, this movie sucks. And the man, granted, you've tried to make them, you really made them unlikable. And it wasn't unlikable in the terms of just because of their actions, but the acting and the overacting and the sub-B movie tropes that you put in this movie just pissed me off. To, like Johnny said, in the last 30 minutes of the movie, it's, no, not even the last 30 minutes, the entire, like 60% of the action sequences, slow-mo. The guys are coming in slow-mo with an arrow.
And I was like, what did these people, did they all of a sudden become Amazon warriors? Because like, you blatantly just said these are super soldiers that get spiritual power to get extra strength, speed. And then all of a sudden, you mess with the wrong sisters, and they know how to fire bow and arrows and, like, fight with swords.
I was so done. I was literally like, all right, please kill the bus. Stop this, and let's get over with this movie.
Mm-hmm.
And I was so frustrated with Black Christmas. So frustrated. Jason Blum, like, you have, I would say 60, 70% of your movies are decent. This is definitely in the 30%.
Yeah.
I couldn't fathom that we made a movie this bad. You made a movie this bad or produced this movie this bad. And I get the message you were trying to get out, but making it as subpar as this film was, I was frustrated. Absolutely frustrated. Sorry we had to get that 5-minute rant out. It's just, I was pissed. Legit pissed at that movie. But we digress. Now, to the DVD releases, before we get to our top 10 movies of the decade. DVD releases that will be coming out. Downton Abbey's film will be coming out on December 17th. Ad Astra, Abominable. No, I had it right. Abominable and Rambo Last Blood will be all coming out on the 17th. The following weekend will be during Christmas. Will be Judy, Kill Team, and I heard some people like the Dr. Highway. I've never seen it, but heard too many things about it. The only movie I've seen was two movies was Ad Astra and Rambo. Ad Astra, I say, is a rental. Mm-hmm. You can definitely skip Rambo.
I have not seen Rambo. That one's on my like catch-up list because I literally have 16 days to see 16 more movies to hit 200.
You and I both.
And so I was like, okay, Rambo's like probably like 90 minutes. Like I can knock that one out pretty quick. So there's a few on my catch-up list where I'm like, oh, okay, all right. I skipped it because I knew it was going to be bad, but let me go ahead and catch it up because I know if I don't see it this year, then I probably won't watch it.
To that point, have a few beers with you when you watch Rambo. Just, it's so over the top. Another movie that was just completely over the top, completely different from what its original franchise was, but I digress. Speaking of which, another movie I watched before we get into our movies was Six Underground, Michael Bay's new Netflix movie.
I started it and I was in an early screening of it at iPick earlier this week and out of the blue, I got an invite to go to Terror Tuesday. So I was like, oh, okay, well, I'll go to Terror Tuesday because that's obviously the better option. This is coming out on Netflix anyway. So I went and saw The Code, Dial Santa, the movie that Home Alone ripped off, where it's a French film, but it's rated R. They actually played an AGFA restored cut back in Fantastic Fest a couple years ago. I didn't go, but I went to this, and it was a brand new, like, 35mm pressing, so it was a pristine film print. It was actually a really good movie. It's actually on Shudder, but it's under the English title, which I forget, but if you go on Shudder, it's on the homepage. So you can kind of see, actually, Steven Spielberg owns a copy of this movie that he got before Home Alone came out, and then Home Alone ripped this movie off and toned it down for American audiences, because obviously this is rated R. You know, the killer kills a dog, and among other things. So, it's very well worth it. And it was a great Terror Tuesday, packed house.
To your point, yeah, you made a great choice. Six Underground. I'll put it this way: the first 20 minutes of Michael Bay's, I would call it return to form, is literally in the first 20 minutes of this film. Literally, it's a rush. An adrenaline rush you were wanting from a Michael Bay movie for the last 15 years before he did all the Transformers movies. After that, it becomes the Michael Bay movies we've seen in the last decade, and it just gets too over the top. I will say this is probably his most grotesque movie. I definitely will say that. But with all that in mind, it's better than four or five in the second Transformers movie, so I definitely will say that. But it's a Michael Bay movie. Can't say too much, but I digress there. All right, guys, since we have gotten all that out of the way, we're going to get right into our top 10 films list of the 2010s. Now, this list we did a little bit differently.
We did them individually.
Yes.
So I guess do we want to do it like punt style? If we have something the same, we just stick a pin in it and punt it until whoever else has it.
Yes.
You want to go? And again, this is not what, in terms of my list, I can't speak for Julian. Mine is not what I think to be the greatest top 10 films, per se. Like, a lot of this has to do with personal taste. And yes. Also, I wanted to kind of get something from almost every genre in there. And I would say I probably have two honorable mentions, which I won't get into too detailed with.
So to that point, we're going to do honorable mentions, because I literally doing this list, I did about 15, 20 movies, and I had to drop it down to 12, then drop it to 10. To his point, these are my personal favorite films of 2010. I wouldn't say that they were more relatable to me, or that I thought that they were just, wow, this was the film of this year or consecutive years where I thought this was the best movie. So that being said, unfortunately, I have not seen as many movies as Johnny, so my list probably won't be as diverse as Johnny's. I do think we might have, I'm going over and under, we're going to have probably two films in common. Everything else is going to be completely different. So with that being said, do you want to go first, or do you want me to go first?
Do you have any honorable mentions?
I definitely do.
Okay, let's each do, I guess, two honorable mentions.
So my first honorable mention that I really just enjoyed a lot, that really stuck and struck me in the core, and that I was just like, okay, I can't put it on my list for reasons, but I would love it, was Fruitvale Station. Ryan Coogler's debut film. Michael B. Jordan, phenomenal. Whole movie is an hour and a half. Ryan Coogler's star into the film's part, I think this is probably his best movie out of the three films he has made. But yeah, I would say this was an honorable mention. Would put it on the list, but unfortunately I couldn't.
Okay. An honorable mention of mine was Terrence Malick's The Tree of Life.
Oh, okay.
Main reason, and you'll probably see, like, if you go visit a lot of publications, top 10, you'll see that on there. It's a beautiful movie. I like the acting, like Brad Pitt's great, but it's also one of those films that I feel is not very rewatchable.
Okay.
And then, like, after those initial feelings, it just kind of wears thin. So that's why it was initially on my top 10, but eventually after I started adding stuff to it, that was one of my last cuts.
Okay. All right, and to that point, my second, I'm going to use it as a two-parter. The first one that I really had to just throw away because I had too many movies in 2018, which you'll see on my list, was Hereditary.
Okay.
But the one that I really, really wanted to put on my list, but unfortunately I couldn't, which we'll explain in a moment, was Arrival. Okay. Denis Villeneuve's, Amy Adams, Jeremy Renner. That movie is fantastic. Watching it again about 2 or 3 months ago made me realize why I thought this was probably one of the best films of 2016. But unfortunately, there's another film on here from 2016 that I had to put on here. And hot take, and I think I'm going to get a lot of crap for this, I don't think this was Denis Villeneuve's best film that he has made in the 2010s. I don't think a lot of people are going to like the movie that I put on here, but I think that movie is better than Arrival and what helped him get the job for Blade Runner 2049. So that's my second runner-up.
My second runner-up is Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse.
Wow.
Okay. I think that is one of the best animated films of the 2010s.
Okay.
And I will leave it at that because Julian's giving me a look. So yes,
I definitely heard.
We'll hold off on talking
about that. We'll hold on to that.
All right, so moving on to the actual numbers. Julian, what's your number 10?
So for my number 10, to give it a hindsight, because of technicality, Johnny told me I couldn't put it on my top 10 at first. Then we finally changed it because it was actually
debuted. It did get play at Sun. I looked it up and I was like, well, I know it's technically, you know, it's like 7 or 8 hours long. And I was like, but did it actually screen? Because I was like, was it basically, if it's awards eligible, which means it has to screen, then technically you can consider it a movie. So I looked and it did screen at Sundance and Cannes. So.
And it won Best Documentary for the 2017 Academy Awards. So that's why I had to ask and make sure. But my number 10 is O.J. Made in America, the ESPN bought documentary from Sundance at that year. Background, I've always was interested in the whole O.J. Simpson case because in 2007 when he got arrested for stealing his own shit, I was wondering, why did this dude get that much for just stealing his own crap back? And going back and researching and diving like the kid I was in the history, I wondered, how in the hell did this man get away with being involved in killing two people? I hate to say it. He was involved in some way, shape, or form killing Nicole Brown and Ron Goldman.
Like, see, what's crazy was this whole thing I remember vividly as a kid. Like, as vividly as, like, sporting events. Was I remember the day, like, the white Bronco chase, like, getting home from school and it being all over TV of everybody in every home in America was sitting in their living room watching footage of this white Bronco driving down the highway with, like, all the cops behind it. And you're like, what is going on? And I didn't, at the time, I didn't know really that much about O.J. Simpson, yeah. That he was, like, this famous football player because it was before my time, like, I was watching Emmitt Smith and Barry Sanders, and, like, those were my football players in the 90s. And then I remember, like, the court case, and I remember I was in, like, fifth grade, and they would actually wheel in the TV cart. Yes, folks, we had the big box TV on the cart, and they would wheel it in. Days. And we would watch, like, we like, in school, watched the O.J. Simpson verdict in class. It was crazy.
And so, to his point, the case happened in 94, and that's when I was born. So, unfortunately, that's why I'm a little too late in the game to understand it. But, like, to his point, one of the events that we had was 9/11, but we're not going to talk about that here. But same concept. Like, I didn't have something as spectacle as what you had. And to see how much influence this man had in America at the time, and to see how this case became the trial of the century, and to see how it dealt with racial relations, classism, celebrity fandom, and the whole nine, and to see it actually be played out in an 8 film, or how ESPN did it into 5 parts, was honorably maybe the best documentary I've seen in this decade, set alongside with Won't You Be My Neighbor and a few others in 13th. But this movie, this documentary itself really shaped the way I looked at LA when I went for my internship, and what I looked and how I really, really solidified my idea of who O.J. Simpson was. So that's why, for me, this was by far one of the best documentaries I saw of the 2010s, and that's why it's number 10 for me.
All right.
And what's your number 10,
Johnny? So my number 10, so it wasn't until I was going over my list with my buddy Brett, and then he was like, so no, like, horror genre films, because that's, like, that's my genre. Okay,
yeah.
And I was like, man, there's so many that I could put, like, Green Room or okay. It Follows. But I ended up doing You're Next, which is,
wow, okay.
In my opinion, it is one of those genre, like the home invasion thing, that just isn't done very well anymore.
No.
They used to do it all the time back in the 70s and 80s. And, like, yeah, a lot of them were B-movies, but they were really, like, the special effects weren't anything to speak of. The acting wasn't great. But it was really scary, the fact of usually it was either a family or one, you know, girl stuck in this home, and it was people breaking in. Like, it was very visceral, very real, and it was always something, like, growing up, those were some of the scariest movies to me. And even this one, Adam Wingard, like, brings some humor to it, but it is definitely, in my opinion, like, the best home invasion, like, horror slasher movie we've had in decades.
Wow.
And so I think that's why I put it into my list, is more of, like, an honorary, you belong in the top 10, not because you're technically a top 10 movie, but because in a genre that I love so much personally, you're the only one that's really done a good job with it.
Mm-hmm.
Even there, you know, there's series out there, The Strangers, and there's other stuff, but, and they do it okay, but not near as well as You're Next. Those masks are now iconic in my eyes, and they really did a cool spin on the home invasion thing, so I really enjoy it. And there are parts in You're Next that other movies have taken, still like stolen. Ready or Not. We talked about Ready or Not earlier this year.
Yeah. And to his point, I was going to say, this movie gave me When a Stranger Calls, the original, not the remake, the original When a Stranger Calls kind of vibes, where you're just like sitting there creeping out, figuring out what the hell is going on. And to his point, this is arguably the best home invasion movie in a very long time. The only one that I will see that was close to it maybe was The Last House on the Left, the remake, and maybe Hush I would maybe put in there. But again, Your Next, when I watched it, was like, wow, this is a real way to revamp the horror franchise. And to his point, I do have a horror, would I call it a horror film? Yeah, I would put it a horror film. I have that up soon, but we'll get to that in a moment. But for my number 9, I'd have to say is another debut film, Damien Chazelle's Whiplash.
So I have to. I have that at 8, so let's go ahead and talk about it.
Okay, perfect. I don't know how to put it any other way than saying this is a movie, a film that you wouldn't expect somebody to make us their first time talking about getting obsessed with the craft to the point of becoming insane, I would say the word I would use. Arguably, J.K. Simmons' best performance.
Oh, easily. Ever. Easily.
Best performance.
There's so many tense scenes where you feel uncomfortable and you're just like, what is about to happen? And
to his point, when he comes in, not for the first time, but the second time, when Miles Teller is going in class and he's like, are you rushing or are you dragging? And that scene there epitomized how much I just was uncomfortable, but how scary J.K. Simmons was. And that's why he won the Academy Award for that year. Like, that movie, fantastic way of starting a peer career off. To making La La Land and then First Man, despite how people feel about First Man. But Chazelle did a phenomenal job with Whiplash.
Like with this, and then he's continued to do it, like to Julian's point with La La Land and First Man, is he's established himself as somebody who over the next 20, 30 years could take over the mantle as one of the great filmmakers, as people like Christopher Nolan and Quentin Tarantino and those guys, as they continue to age. Scorsese, he, at least to me with Irishman, seems like he's kind of bowing out and doing a swan song of sorts. I'm sure he might do other things, but not on that same level or scope. So Damien Chazelle is definitely a director to watch for the foreseeable future. And Whiplash was where it started. And even in the tense scenes in First Man and La La Land, not so much, but in First Man, they never have that same sort of uncomfortable, like your heart is like beating really rapidly and you just can't, you want the scene to end, but you don't know how you want it to end, and you just, it's so good.
And to this point, even at the ending of the film, you're uncomfortable with the way that the film ends, because you're like, am I satisfied that Miles Teller was able to perform for JK, or am I uncomfortable, or I'm sad at the fact that Miles Teller just became JK? And the movie does not stop with that kind of ideals in the entire film, and that's why it had to be on here. And weirdly enough, I don't know why, but I'm starting to look at my list now. I have a lot of debut films for a lot of directors in this list, and that tells you a lot about what kind of films that I like, but we won't get to those just yet. But Johnny, what is your number 9?
My number 9 is Inside Llewyn Davis by the Coen Brothers.
I still have yet to watch Inside Llewyn Davis. That's
so we had Oscar Isaac and Carey Mulligan, a lot of good actors, but this film, it's still got some of those Coen sensibilities with the humor and everything like that, but it's really emotional and heartfelt, and throughout you feel the struggle this man is having just trying to do his passion, and then there's so many other people around there doing the same, and it's really great. I mean, I don't know how else to say it. By the end of it, you feel good when he finally, like, he gets to show his talent. And it's, like, as much as I love A Star Is Born and some of the other musician films, and, you know, this one is something else. And I really, really enjoyed it.
See, and that's why I want to watch it so much because everybody keeps telling me that this is the best Coen Brothers movies of the decade. So, and crazy enough, I've seen almost every other Coen Brothers beside a movie this year, this decade, besides Inside Llewyn Davis. So it is still on my list. I need to watch it. So, duly noted. I'm going to have to go look at it. Now, Johnny already said his number 8, but for me, my number 8, Sicario.
Okay.
So that's the film from Denis Villeneuve where I was like, okay, this for me was that film. Now, everybody talks about Hugh Jackman and Prisoners. I liked Prisoners. It's just, I don't know, for some apparent reason, maybe I was too late to watching it because I watched it, I think, last year. I just, it didn't resonate with me as much for Prisoners, whereas Sicario, watching it in 2015 when it first came out and getting it on DVD, I knew that after that film, I said this was the best movie of 2015, for me at least. Who? What is not to say? I think Emily Blunt, this is her top tier performance. Like, this isn't her best, but top tier performance. Benicio del Toro, I think this was one of his arguably best films. Josh Brolin, despite being Thanos 3 years later, this is his best performance before that point. And you just seeing the gears turn on how the U.S. government is trying to deal with the drug cartel in Mexico and how they're playing dirty and it's messing with Emily Blunt's mind. And you're looking, and one thing about this film that I just really was blown off about is now looking back at it, and I watched, I think, a month ago, there's so many actors and actresses in this film that just begun to explode in the latter 2010s that you didn't expect, like John Bernthal, you know, like I said, Daniel Kaluuya, who goes and does two films, one of them that's also on my list. And you just have all these different actors in this different movie that uses music and lack thereof with the score and the beautiful cinematography just make a phenomenal film. And to that point, I kind of couldn't put my other honorable mention in here, Hell or High Water, just mm-hmm. because that's another great film that I really just was like, wow, this is amazing. But for me, best film of 2015, Sicario, Denis Villeneuve. So,
that was your 8?
That was my 8.
Okay. We already talked about my 8, which was Whiplash.
My number 7, Zero Dark Thirty. Another movie where I was just like, I don't know why I have a lot of like military films in this movie. And I have one more that's above this one. Catherine Bigelow, Bigelow's like second film after The Hurt Locker. No, this is her film right after Hurt Locker, so her second. No, not her second. I'm blanking right now. But this is another movie where I was just sitting there wondering, this is how the government operates. So, you know, one of the biggest things while I was growing up in high school was the fact that, you know, after, like I said, one of the biggest moments in 2002 for me when I was 8 was 9/11 and this decade-old manhunt for Osama bin Laden. And how Catherine does a phenomenal job of showing this decade-old manhunt and how it's portraying with, not just portraying with a woman who's basically trying to be like the diplomat from the CIA, but also how the SEALs, the government, and how all the other officials are dealing with this at the same time. Almost, like I said, almost felt as great as how I felt with The Hurt Locker and how it's just, it deals with the mental capacity and the mental awareness of dealing with something as big as this. And I don't know, Catherine hit this out of the park. I wish this would have made, no, this didn't win best film, did it? No, it didn't. Mm-mm. I wish it would have been like the second honorable mention because I forgot what film won that year anyway. But Zero Dark Thirty, another military film or a government film that I was just like blown out of the water.
Have you watched The Report yet?
No, I have not.
Yeah. I watched The Report with Adam Driver, and it's good, but it's way more dense than Zero Dark Thirty, and it just goes into more the behind-the-scenes stuff.
Like, what the...
Even at one point, because it basically starts in 2001, like, right after the Twin Towers.
Okay.
And then every now and then it just pushes forward a year and just is following him as he's trying to get this information on, like, what are we doing to these terrorists?
Yeah.
And then he even gets to the point where he's in the room and it's playing the trailer for Zero Dark Thirty and he's like in the room doing the actual research and it talks about like how it's bullshit essentially.
Okay. All right. So wait, where did you find The Report? Is it on?
It's on Amazon Prime.
Okay. All right. I'm going to have to go look at that. All right, cool. That's another one I'm going to have to watch.
All right. My number 7 is Dunkirk.
Damn, that was number 15. Okay.
So, all right. Dunkirk is one of those movies from Christopher Nolan that I don't think initially has gotten that much love. Mm-hmm. However, I feel like this is a movie, like, when I've watched it the most recent time a few months ago, that I'm just like, by the end of it, I'm like, wow. Why was not everybody in the country talking about Dunkirk when it was out last year? It was, I hadn't watched it since, so I watched it in theater in 70mm, and then when it came out in 4K, watched it like once at home, and I hadn't watched it again for a while. And I'm like, this is, it's a masterwork. This is one of the greatest war movies that's been made since Saving Private Ryan. Yeah. And we'll see 1917, I'm looking at you.
Have you seen 1917?
I have not.
So that, I was going to say, a lot of people are trying to compare 1917 to Dunkirk. And to your point, I wholeheartedly wanted to put Dunkirk in this, because I think this is Christopher Nolan's best film of the 2010s. And the way he films it and the way that he basically plots out the story for you was just beautiful, absolutely beautiful. And I agree, like, this is arguably the best film I've seen. And like, to his point, like, to Johnny's point, I only watched it at the Bullock Theater in Austin in IMAX once, and then I bought it in 4K as soon as it came out, and ironically enough, it was the same time I bought my OLED TV and played it on there and was just mesmerized by how beautiful it looked. If I probably would have watched it probably another time or so, it probably would have made it in my top 10. But damn, that was such a good movie. Speaking of another beautiful movie, my number 6, Skyfall.
Okay.
Wait, do you have it anywhere? No. All right, perfect. So, to our point, Sam Mendes, who did 1917, Roger Deakins and him did a collaboration to do the 23rd Bond film. And in my personal opinion, this is, again, my personal opinion, this is arguably one of the best Bond films that has ever been made, and maybe one of the best, like, top-tier espionage films that we've had in recent memory, not excluding Mission Impossible Fallout. But Skyfall was a jump in the vein for the Bond films that it really needed. I feel like Casino Royale was a fresh new take that we needed after the god-awful Die Another Day that we got with Pierce Brosnan's mm-hmm. James Bond. And I will say that because I went to go see that stupid-ass movie with my dad in the theaters, and I was just mad that I saw Pierce Brosnan sky, like, surfing on a tidal wave of frozen cold water, but I digress. But yes, Skyfall was just a film that I just was like, wow, can I get another one like this soon? Daniel Craig's best performance in the Bond series. Judi Dench does a phenomenal job. Javier Bardem, again, 4 years after doing No Country for Old Men, does this film, and it just, it hits you so much, and it does different themes and different Bond that most Bond films didn't do at all, about, you know, dealing with your sins, you know, espionage or dropping off of fallen soldiers, creating monster soldiers like Bond and Silver. Like, that whole thing was just phenomenally well done, and I think that's why arguably it's the best espionage movie of the 2010s.
No, I really dig it. I'm one of those people that Casino Royale just still holds a special place in my heart, just because it doesn't rely, it has like one and a half, like, sort of big action set pieces.
Yeah.
And then the rest is very, like, grounded, and I appreciated that a whole lot about it. But I like Skyfall equally. I just, they're just very two different
movies.
Mm-hmm. All right. My number 6 is a recent movie, which I won't go into too much about it because we reviewed it a few months ago, and that's Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
I figured you'd have
this. I mean, in the last decade, I've got to put this ahead of his other few movies, because I feel like this is the best since Inglourious Basterds, which yep. was the previous decade. I watched, it just came out in 4K this week. I already watched it again. Got the deluxe edition, which has the vinyl in it and everything. That's why it hangs off the shelf. I mean, it's fantastic. Brad Pitt and Leo are great. Margot Robbie, despite limited dialogue, which is on purpose, it does a phenomenal job. I love it. It's Quentin at his best. This alternate reality The music's phenomenal. I've listened to this soundtrack more than any other soundtrack this year. And yeah, I'm looking forward to his next film, but I'll keep watching this because it's a super easy watch. I mean, literally you can put it in and you're automatically hooked from like the opening scene all the way to the last, to the climax, the big battle. And it's just, it's a phenomenal movie in my eyes.
I would agree. To your point, I had that at number 14. Unfortunately, I'm one of the weird ones that think The Irishman just weeds it out just a little bit. But I had to put another film in 2019 on this list, which we will get to in a moment. I don't know if you would agree, but I would agree. Quentin Tarantino's best film, coming after Django, and then coming after Hateful Eight. This was a wow. Yes, Quentin Tarantino is fully back into what he considers his best idea of filmmaking. And the way he filmed Los Angeles, the 1969 Los Angeles that most of us wanted to live and wanted us to love, he did a phenomenal job. And I just, there's not much you can say about that. I would agree with Johnny on that. Now, my number five, which we can finally talk about, is Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse.
Okay.
I think it's the best, to his point, I think this is the best animated film that we've had this decade, arguably. Now, there are animated films that I would say had really great moments, like Up and a couple of others, but I would say the epitome of what animation was is this movie right here, Spider-Verse. I would definitely say it. Shameik Moore did a phenomenal job. I keep forgetting who's Spider B Park, who's Peter B. Parker. I forgot his name. But
oh, from New Girl.
I know.
Josh Johnson.
There you go. And basically everybody else in the entire cast just does a phenomenal job. And one of my things that I've been saying about Spider-Man movies for a long time is they don't do anything different. They just keep revamping the same thing over and over again. That's what's my issue with Homecoming and Far From Home just a tad bit.
Yeah.
But this movie completely says, let's swipe the slate clean. Yep. Yes, it's an intro. It's a, like a,
It is an origin movie, but they get it out of the way quickly.
Very quickly.
And you bring in these other characters, and there's a character for everybody, for kids. You've got Peter B. Parker for the old people, older people.
Who watched Spider-Man when it first came out.
And then you've got, the spider pig, and I don't remember the spider robot for the kids. You got Spider-Gwen. Hailee Steinfeld did a great job.
Phenomenal job.
Between that and Bumblebee, she had a great year last year. Like I said, it just missed the cut for me, and that's really because I wanted to put one animated movie in here, but I honestly, when I laid it all out there, I was like, I can't say any of these really fit in my top 10 like all these other films. And also, I've been on an I Lost My Body kick lately, and that movie is just... Oh, I saw it at Fantastic, and I don't know if you remember this. This was the one film that it wasn't my favorite of Fantastic Fest, but it was the one where as soon as I got out of the theater, I just felt so heartfelt and warm inside, and I was like, I need to tell everybody I know to watch this.
And you keep telling me about it, but the thing is I don't know where to find it.
Just came out on Netflix about a week and a half ago. It's only like 85 minutes long, people, and it is in French. They do have an English dub if you're somebody who can't read, doesn't want to read. And I think Dev Patel is doing the voice of the English version.
Oh, wow, okay.
I did watch like 30 minutes of the English dub. And like Dev Patel is great, but I did notice that some of like the side characters, you can tell they're probably just like generic voice actors. So I went back and put on the French. This one also has an amazing score. I actually wore my gaming head. I have great speakers. I actually wore my gaming headset when I was listening to it, just because it has a really great like surround soundtrack.
Okay.
But yeah, tell me you don't watch that and want to give anybody you love or care about like the biggest hug in the world afterwards, like your family, your friends. It would be a great date movie. It is for this time. Like if you watch that, like it will seem really odd trying to explain to somebody, yeah, let's watch this movie about a hand trying to find its body. But it is so endearing and touching and moving, and sad but also hopeful. It is so good. And I was actually talking about this with Brett, that if Pixar wins the best animated instead of this, it is a travesty. Because no animated film this year is even close.
To be honest with you, to that point, I saw the end for the Golden Globe nominations, which most likely will transcend into the Academy nominations. Hot take. Golden Globe nominations suck this year. We didn't talk about it, but they definitely suck. We won't discuss that. That's a whole nother event on another time. But looking at all those films, the only one I didn't see is that film, and I really want to watch it just because Johnny literally would not stop talking about it at work when we were working together, and that's why I really want to get back into watching it. So now that it's on Netflix, definitely probably watching that tonight. Thank you for letting me know what movie I'm watching tonight. All right. Now to your point. What's your number five?
Number five. We're back to Nolan. It's 2010's Inception. I just got done raving about Once Upon a Time in Hollywood's soundtrack. Inception is the best score of the decade.
I would agree.
It is so inventive. This is a smart science fiction movie that played to the masses. I cannot remember the last time, or if ever, that a smart science fiction / action movie played to the masses the way this did.
I would agree.
This movie got your everyday Joe who doesn't care about intelligent movies go watch a movie.
Yes.
It's phenomenal. It's one of those films that people were talking straight, like, for a long time after the movie came out about what happened at the end. Like, there are all these little nuances that you can find throughout the movie. And to this day, there is no definitive answer. And I love that it is left up to you as the viewer. You decide what Cobb's fate it was.
And to this point, to Johnny's point, it's crazy that this film came out in 2010. And to this day, 9 years later, I still have friends who try to argue with me about the ending of this film. And to his point, this movie was number 11. And I knew I left it off the list for a reason, because I said most likely Johnny put Inception on your list, and I knew it. To your point, this film just, it's everything that you want out of a Christopher Nolan film. Like, again, I just ranted about Dunkirk, but to his point, I there's nothing else you can say about it. This is going to be a science fiction film that we're going to go 20, 30 years down the line, and we're going to dissect the shit out of, like most people are doing with The Shining, and try to connect clues.
I wouldn't be surprised if the kids of our generation are shown this in film school.
I would not be surprised either. Like, Christopher, like this movie, Dunkirk, and arguably The Dark Knight would be three of the Christopher Nolan films that I would know that somebody in film class is going to be like, these are the movies that y'all need to watch. And again, to his point, you can make so many different interpretations about Cobb's fate at the end of this film. But one thing that you cannot not say about this film is how exciting, action-packed, and thought-provoking this film is. When Christopher Nolan did Dunkirk and he remastered all of his films in 4K, the second movie that I picked out of Christopher Nolan's filmography when it came out was Inception. That's how beautiful this movie was. I have it in DVD, Blu-ray, and 4K just because of how awesome that movie was. So I agree. Inception was phenomenal, and I wouldn't have been mad at myself if we did not get to talk about Inception. But thank you for bringing it up.
All right, number four for you.
Parasite.
Very nice.
So, Bong Joon-ho's Parasite. I think it's going to be the best film of 2019. As of now.
It should be.
I think it's the best film of 2019. And I would put that right under Irishman and Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. But most likely, I think for the Academy, they're going to give it to Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. But we're not going to talk about that just yet. But Bong Joon-ho's Parasite film is something just to sit and think about. Like, this is another think piece movie that you can sit down and watch, and you could turn it off and not even think about it so much, but the story is just so phenomenal. And what's crazy is this is a Korean film, a South Korean film, but you can literally take this entire story and put it in America and it would be the exact same. A family that's in the working class, poor working class, basically learns how to finesse and try to get themselves up into a rich high-class family. And seeing the different family divides, the socialism, the classism, and all that divide together as the film goes on was just mind-tapingly beautiful. And what's one thing I would say is, yes, it's a comedy throughout the 60% of the film, but the end of it, it hits you hard so quick about some of the certain notes and certain of the lessons that this film is trying to give you. And it's just phenomenal. You could take so many different themes out of this film and you could talk about it for days. And that's why I think Bong Joon-ho's Parasite is probably the best film of 2019 as of now. And I can watch it again whenever it comes out on DVD. But yeah, for me, this is arguably one of the best social films that we have seen for a while. Besides the two that I... Actually, damn. Besides the three that I have above it. But we'll talk about those in just a moment. Any thoughts on Parasite, or do you want to go
straight to number four? I love it. It was my favorite film of Fantastic Fest. I went again and took my parents to see it. I'm of Korean descent, so I'm, you know, somewhat aware of the stuff that is happening in that. And I think his depiction of it and his ability as a filmmaker to seamlessly weave and construct scenes that can genuinely shift from humor to shock and awe to drama to horror and then back is truly masterful. And he's a treasure. There's a reason they renamed one of our Alamos here after him. So I absolutely adore that film, and I'm sure with time it will probably work its way up there. Like I said, I've only seen it twice and I feel like there's more to it. So I'm definitely looking forward to it. I think I have a Mondo print that's was supposed to be here some time ago, but it got delayed. But I have a Mondo Parasite print that should be here eventually.
Hopefully it will be soon.
My number four is Darren Aronofsky's 2010 film Black Swan.
Yes.
This, okay. So right. While your next was kind of I had to put a genre film in here just to reflect my personal taste. This is a film that is truly magnificent, and is, when you pull it back, it's a horror film.
It's a horror film.
It's a drama horror film. It's about beauty that turn and an obsession with a passion that becomes an obsession that literally steers this woman with fantastic gifts down this crazy path of self-destruction. And it's, you know, it's a sexual thriller, and there's, gosh, it just is crazy that this, you basically take this thing that, you know, a lot of people think about when they think of ballerinas is they're obsessed, they get used up, and then choreographers move on to whoever the new hot ballerina is, and then the other one basically doesn't work again. And this is about what this woman is willing to do mentally and physically to achieve greatness, and then what cost that does to her mind and body to try to get there. And it is truly horrific. And Natalie Portman 100% deserved that award. That was a phenomenal
performance
for the ages. The only thing I will say is this is one of the toughest rewatches. Out of my top 10, this is probably the toughest rewatch. Like I say, Terrence Malick's Tree of Life, that's a tough rewatch. That's not a tough rewatch because it's tough. That's a tough rewatch because it's a long movie with a lot of filler. It's very pretty to look at.
Yeah.
This is a tough rewatch because Whiplash is a tough rewatch, but not like this. This makes you feel icky.
Very disgusting. Like, I remember watching it when it first came out, because my cousin loved Natalie Portman because she was a huge fan of her in the Star Wars movies. Why, I don't know. But we watched it, and she literally did not like Natalie Portman for a very long time. And I can still remember just watching Natalie Portman turn, and just my back would just literally just feel like spiders are crawling up my spine of how uncomfortable I was watching Black Swan.
To also, your point, Mila Kunis's best performance she's ever done.
I would also agree.
That it was this point I was like, oh, she can act.
Exactly.
And then I'm like, where has she been?
She's been doing stupid ass rom-coms. Yep. That's a whole other conversation to have. But I digress. But to his point, that's why I was thinking of Black Swan, but because of how uncomfortable every time I watch Black Swan made me feel, that's why I had to put it down there. And to his point, it's like Whiplash for me. It's a film where you're talking about somebody who's has a gift, who's beautiful at this gift, who has aspiring portrayals on it, just like The Perfection, but not as wild as The Perfection. But you're watching this film and you're watching somebody who has a beautiful gift go and turn into something completely obsessive and very vile, I would call it. And just seeing Natalie Portman turn that way just made me way too uncomfortable. Whereas, like he said, with Whiplash, it's more of a rewatch for me because it doesn't dive as much as Tarkovsky does. But still, watching Black Swan to this day, I'm just like, phenomenal film. Like how I feel about Hereditary, phenomenal film. I get very uncomfortable watching it, and it's just weird. I don't know why, but that's just how I feel about Black Swan. Phenomenal film, though. I definitely would put it in my top 20 of the decade. Another film. I hope you have this. This is my second film that I hope that you had on your list. My number three. The Social Network.
Okay, we're gonna have to put a pin in that.
Yes, I knew I was gonna have this one on there. So we're gonna leave David Fincher alone for now. I'm gonna tell you why I have it at number three.
When yeah, we get to I want to hear. I want to hear why.
I already know where it is.
I'm already thinking in my head. I hope he's got a fastball.
I got a fastball for you. I promise. So we're gonna put a pin in The Social Network. Number two. Number three.
Number three. Mad Max: Fury Road.
Okay, go ahead.
So, this is the best action movie of the decade.
I would also agree.
I don't care how much anybody loves the Marvel movies. This is the best action movie of the decade, easily. This is the most, I mean, well acted. You took a dead franchise, brought it back to life with a different person playing the lead. You also, something that people always are looking to, they make fun of movies like Star Wars and other stuff for trying to have like these great female heroines, and for some people they don't work. In here,
Charlize Theron
is the best female. I don't care, like, you give me Wonder Woman, Captain Marvel, Black Widow, whatever. Give me Furiosa. She is the best female heroine we have ever got on screen.
I would completely agree.
She is a badass. She doesn't need Mad Max. They just happen to work well together.
Upon each other and working for the same comic cost. That's basically it.
George Miller, like, think about this. Before he did this, he made Happy Feet. Right? Yeah. And then he took years away from this franchise.
Almost came, 30 years. Came no, back even longer than that.
And made this. You had mostly real set pieces doing these giant cars tearing the crap out of each other. You made it just heart pounding. The score is crazy, junky XL. Like, yeah. Don't even, like, Immortan Joe is a fantastic villain. Yes. He is terrifying. This movie in 2015, I don't even know how many times I watched this. Like, that, my disc is probably in need of replacing. I watched this movie so many times.
To Johnny's point, I was going to say that, yes, I have two action movies on my list, Skyfall, and I would guess you could say Spider-Verse in there. But if there was one action film this entire decade where I was like, damn, that's how you make an action movie, was Mad Max: Fury Road. to Johnny's point, Tom Hardy has literally maybe a page or two pages of lines, does a phenomenal fucking job. Charlize Theron, best performance of this decade, best heroine I've seen since almost, Sigourney Weaver in Alien. Like, wow. And to Johnny's point, I don't care what anybody says. Yes, I'm a diehard Marvel superhero fan. I love my comic book movies. I've been there since the beginning of X-Men, since Spider-Man. Ooh, about to sneeze. Sorry. Excuse me. So, to that point, like, you have all these Marvel movies that has nothing but full-blown action. There is not any single one of them, including the ones that we said are the best Marvel movies, that has the set pieces that George Miller has put for this film. Just, I have not seen a more action-packed film like this in a long time that has a great, phenomenal story as it does. And I could literally, like you said, I can literally watch it for years. I don't have the DVD yet. I was waiting for a 4K remastering, which I still have yet to find at Best Buy. But they have the Black Chrome edition, which is something I really want to get my hands on so I can be able to watch it in black and white just because. But yes.
Yeah, I have that on my disc.
Have you seen it? Have you seen the Black Chrome edition? How does it look?
It looks fantastic. I still prefer the color one. Okay. Whereas, like, with Logan, I actually really like the black and white. Logan. Yes, I agree. But Mad Max, there's something about the colors of, like, the tan and the blue sky. And then when you see blood or the guys, you know, with the white faces. And the other thing with this movie is I care more about the safety of those girls than I cared about the safety of the world in the Marvel and DC movies.
I agree.
Giant beam in the sky. Da, da, da.
Ooh, destroying New York.
I'm like, oh, these poor girls have been enslaved. Like, they're raped, made to make babies for this disgusting, like, dictator. And Charlize Theron, who is supposed to be one of his, like, top people, is like, nope, screw F it. That. You're I'm getting these girls out of here. Like, Black Christmas, did you none of y'all watch this? This, like, is how you do this female empowerment.
Female empowerment film is literally Mad Max Fury Road. If any director, not woman directors, well, some woman directors if you want, but men, if you decide that you want to make a women empowerment film and you want to know how to make it, please go pick up Mad Max Fury Road and understand this is your roadmap. Please don't fuck it up. Like, this is, that's how you make an action film. That was number 12. It definitely would have been on there if I did not rewatch Skyfall recently, but I digress. Damn, that's a beautiful film. Number two, Get Out.
Okay. That almost made it in mine.
So, to Johnny's point, because all right. So, for me, again, as you can tell, I have a lot of director's debut films on here. Get Out was one of those films I was just sitting there like, I actually see this happening. It's a horror. For me, it's a horror film. For a lot of people, I don't know why, but it's a comedy thriller, ? Which, to my point, I'm like, what the hell are you watching? But Get Out was by far one of the best experiences I had in the film in 2017. Watching that and be able to see Daniel Kaluuya basically just shift the way he is doing in the film. And I forgot the lady who basically, him and the woman, basically were doing the trance, the first scene together when he's going through his trauma and stuff like that. And she uses it to make him, like, get hypnosis. That is arguably one of the best well-acted scenes I've seen in a very long time. And it's just how much it just grinds the tension just by acting. Nothing else, but literally just the acting between those two was phenomenal. This film, again, to Johnny's point throughout this entire list when we talk about horror, I felt like in the 2000s, because I was a huge horror fan in the 2000s, literally, it was jack shit. I hate to be that guy, but in the 2000s, I really didn't see that many horror films that blew my mind. In the 2010s, there's so many that came out that you're just like, wow, there were really good ones. And there's a few of them that stand out, like Hereditary, Green Room, The Witch, It Follows. And I would say Get Out is another one of those films that you sit out and watch and say, these five or six films that I just mentioned are the epitome of what horror should have been when I was growing up in the 2000s. And I would say Get Out for Jordan Peele, absolutely magnum opus for him. Maybe not yet because he only made two films. I loved Us, but I feel like Get Out was a way better, tighter film than most of the films that I've watched. So for me, that's why Get Out is number two.
So my number two is Arrival.
I figured you'd have put Denis Villeneuve's Arrival.
Yeah, so Arrival I saw back at Fantastic Fest of that year, 2016. And at the time, I did not, like, I really liked it, but I didn't understand, like, what I was witnessing. This okay. is a film that every time I've seen it since has gotten better and better and better. And it's also a film that I think in the generations to come, very much like Inception and probably Dunkirk, but I think even more so, I think Arrival is going to be one of those needed watches for film students, people yeah. who want to learn the craft of filmmaking and how you structure a film, and then
yeah.
how you shoot a film. Like, this is absolutely gorgeous as long as you don't have a bad TV
or projector. I would completely agree.
Like, this is a film that if you do not have the right equipment, it will not look the way it's supposed to, and the way it's supposed to look is gorgeous. Like, there is so much commentary going on behind the scenes as well in this, and I mean, the visuals, the acting, the score, I mean, it's just, the more I've watched it, the more I'm like, gosh, I was kind of off by giving it, I think I gave it initially like a 4 stars, and the more I watched it, I'm like, this is creeping up on 5, which I don't give many 5s, but the more I watch it now, I'm like, oh, it's definitely a 4.5, and the more I've watched it, I'm like,
it's close I to
think,
a 5 for me.
I think within the next couple of years, I'll consider this a perfect 5. So to me, this is a near-perfect science fiction film. It's thought-provoking. It tells so much about us as a people and, like, the way we do things. And it's so, like, it seems so simple in the moment while you're watching the film, like, when the solutions start happening. But you go back and watch it again, and you're like, how did they not see this? And then it's just so good.
It talks about the human nature and the
humanity. Our first inclination to everything exactly. as humans is to be defensive, and then at the slightest hint of not understanding what's in front of us, we go from being excessively defensive to overly aggressive.
Yep.
And that goes that's us towards each other as well. And I think Villeneuve really kind of amps this up as, like, this is the way we react to things, and, like, we only have that small voice of reason within our whole population, just like everybody only has that small voice of reason in their head.
Mm-hmm.
And if we as a people don't listen to that person, then poof, eventually the wrong person's gonna be in control and push the wrong button, and then next thing you know, we're Skynet takes over because we end up killing most of ourselves, and then the machine's Alexa takes over.
Now, to his point, I and this is probably just me being there, and like I said, I knew that this is going to be a movie that's going to have a hot take. I do like Sicario, for now, a lot better than Arrival. But to his point, I remember watching it in L.A. for the first time in 2016. And I was just blown away by it. Amy Adams does a phenomenal job. Forrest Whitaker does a phenomenal job. Jeremy Renner does a phenomenal job. But one thing that, to his point and what we were talking about, is how Denis talks about human nature and how that progresses throughout the movie, and it has such a heartwarming message at the end of it, to the point where we have talked about this before, but there's not a lot of movies that make me as emotional or heartfelt when I watched the film, and this was one of those films. I couldn't sit there and just be just calm about it because of how great Denny wrapped up the film to a point where you're just like, wow, if I was in Amy Adams' shoes, I don't know how I would have done it. And just a phenomenal film all around. I have that film at number 2 of the 2016, but unfortunately, it has been beat out by my number 1 pick, which is, again, a debut film from Barry Jenkins, Moonlight. There's a lot of things I cannot say bad about Moonlight. This film, I don't know where you have it in your list of the top 10 films. I mean, the films of the decade.
I probably have it just outside of the top 10. And the only negative I have about Moonlight, and believe me, I love it. I own the Mondo,
Mondo
variant. I have a variant of the print.
Oh, damn.
So believe me, I love this. This is the only Best Picture winner I have a print of. So I have high regard for this movie. My only negative of this film, and it's not on the film even, it's on me. I hold rewatches or rewatchability that plays a lot into factoring not my initial score, because Moonlight is definitely a 4.5 film for me. The problem is from like taking it as a whole, especially when I'm judging a full decade, how many times have I watched you? How many times do I think I'm going to watch you over the next decade? Like, how much are you going to stay with me? Like, I'll always, anytime somebody asks me, should I watch Moonlight? Oh, you haven't seen it? Yes, you need to watch it. You need to turn your cell phone on silent and you need to watch the whole thing at once. You can take a bathroom break, but it is a fantastic movie and you need to watch it. It tells a lot about our society. It tells a lot about, stories that a lot of us don't know that people go through.
Yeah.
And it's very heartwarming and there are great performances throughout. But again, the one tick on it is I don't know that I'm ever going to be like, oh, you haven't seen Moonlight. Let's watch it together.
Okay.
Like, yeah, you go watch Moonlight.
Okay, to his point.
And we'll talk about it afterwards. But you go watch Moonlight, come back, we'll talk about it. It's not one where I want to sit down and like go on that journey again, because it is a difficult journey.
It is a very difficult journey. I would agree. To his point, I've watched this film in its entirety 3 times. To his point, it's one of those films where, again, judging it off of rewatchability, to his point, it's not a rewatch that I could basically say, okay, I have this much time, what movie am I going to pick? Moonlight. All right, cool. It's one of those films that you have to, for me, like how I feel about 12 Years, Fruitvale Station, some other honorable mentions in my list, it's a, let me mentally prepare myself to get ready to watch what I'm watching. Because to his point, for me, as a black boy who not lived in that kind of hood or lived in that neighborhood, but going to school in that situation, being in a school that's right across the street from the hood in Beaumont and dealing with what I was dealing with and basically feeling like I was Chiron, just being a young black boy who knows that he loves being a nerd and loves being some like different from what everybody else likes, and learning how to deal with that growing up in a school system that's just hard and rough, right? And on that latter note, like, it was just really rough to be able to put myself in those shoes and see that, because like I see a lot of me and a lot of my friends that I've had growing up as Chiron, and like literally watching it the first time at Arclight in LA, I was holding back tears of how much this was so relevant to my life. And Barry Jenkins does a phenomenal job. And for this to be the first film where an all-black cast was basically won the Best Picture says a lot about how beautiful this film was. The story is phenomenal. The acting, like Johnny said, is A1. Like, a beautiful film to watch. It's just, for me, like Johnny said, in terms of rewatchability, it's one of those movies that I have to basically mentally prepare myself to get into, because it is a very difficult watch to see how Chiron navigates his life to be where he is, and how unfortunately how I feel about a lot of my friends that live, or one of my old friends from Beaumont, and how they're dealing with life now. And it's just really a rough watch, but arguably the best film that I have seen in the 2010s, for me at least. And I would not hesitate to tell anybody, like Johnny said, you ever seen Moonlight? I will give you my copy. Go watch it. We can talk about it as soon as you're done, because I know that this is the best film that I've seen in a long time. So to Johnny's point, absolutely. This is exactly why I love Moonlight. That's why it's number one on my list. And yeah, that's exactly why, unfortunately, I already know, that's why it's your number one is my number three, which we could definitely talk about. What is your number one yet again?
So this was, for me, this was the easiest decision when making this top 10. Because basically when we decided we're doing the top 10, I was like, oh, well, I know what number one is. Let me just figure out the rest. And this film came out in 2010. So this was at the very beginning of the decade. And that's The Social Network, David Fincher's modern masterpiece about the true story of Mark Zuckerberg. And you've got everything in there. You've got the Reznor, Atticus Finch score. Your cast is Jesse Eisenberg, Andrew Garfield, Justin Timberlake, Armie Hammer, not to mention Rooney Mara, Brenda Song, yes. Dakota Johnson.
Yes.
It is phenomenal. It's based on a book called The Accidental Billionaires, or
The Accidental Billionaire.
But it's so good. From that opening scene where it's just the two of them in the bar and she's breaking up with him, and it's just the dialogue between them two, and you go back and you watch any of the special features on David Fincher directing them to for that scene, how many takes they did to just get the scene of them breaking up, it shows how much of a perfectionist he is, how much he just relishes in his craft.
Yes.
And nothing that you get on screen or that comes in through the score is not basically without his knowing and him wanting it to be there. And like, it was one of those films where, even though by the time you see it, like, it has been years since the events happened, but like those scenes where, and this was really like Andrew Garfield's coming out party, was like that scene where he gets weaseled out of the company and he only gets like 0.03%. And you were just like, this scumbag.
Yeah. I completely agree. This is David Fincher's best film of the 2010s. I don't care what anybody says. This is arguably maybe his best, no, not his best film since the 2000s either. No. But I would say this is David Fincher's best film. Gone Girl, phenomenal, no. But even his like TV shows, they try to reminisce what he did in 2010 with The Notebook. And I'm going to say it right now. Oh. Jesse Eisenberg's best performance.
Oh, yeah. Still to this day.
Justin Timberlake's best performance. Andrew Garfield's best performance. Like, literally everybody in that entire film came and rocked the world. I remember watching it in 2010. And crazy enough, I made Facebook because of the trailer. Because it came out in 2010. I remember watching the trailer on IGN, on its website, like 6 or 7 months before the film came out. And I was like, let me go make a Facebook just because, right? He said, what's better than $1 billion? $5 million friends or something like that. I forgot how the slogan was for the film. And I was like, let me go try to be like a billion friends by any chance. And I added myself on Facebook. And to that point, this film, David Fincher does such a phenomenal job of articulating different scenes. And you could tell every bit and scene of this film, he had some way of saying, this is perfection. This is perfection. This is perfection. And granted, some people's biggest takes on this film, in which I kind of was dumb, well, I think it's dumb in my opinion, the dialogue is a little bit quick. It's really quick and fast paced. And Unfortunately, I'm used to that because my mom used to make me watch Gilmore Girls, which is as quick paced as what Social Network is. But besides the point, it's beautifully shot. Music in the points where it needs to be, or the lack thereof. Everybody comes in hard knocks. Like I said, I think Justin Timberlake as an actor was good, but not great. I said, this is how, if somebody could teach Justin Timberlake how to actually act, this is what we could have gotten. And it was phenomenal. Jesse Eisenberg, I still say it to this day, I just don't like him as a person. Now, I mean, as an actor, but if there was one film I could say, hey, this is what he can do to act, it would be this film. And Andrew Garfield, same thing. I just feel like Andrew, with the films that he's been making latter in the 2010s, just didn't give him the repertoire that he needed to get him to where he is. But David Fincher said, I'm going to show you the ropes, mm-hmm. and I'm going to show you what
Even
it takes.
Even Armie Hammer playing two roles.
the Winklevoss twins. And it's just like, who could have done that? Who could have put you in that chair and said, hey, play
it? I remember when this came out, and like I saw Armie Hammer, I was like, why doesn't he play Batman?
I would have been so happy if Armie Hammer would have been Christian Bale as Batman. Like, I would have been so happy. Armie Hammer does a phenomenal job as the Winklevoss twins, and that's why I was so mad when they recasted Batman. I'm like, don't do Ben Affleck. Just go get goddamn Armie Hammer, because who? Yeah, I can harp on that a while. This is David Fincher's arguably one of his best films, and I can't stop talking about it. The only reason, and I'm going to be honest with you, the only reason why it's probably number three and why it's not number two right now on my list is most likely because I haven't seen it since 2015, 2016. I've watched it maybe six times and from 2010 to 2016, but I bet you if I were to watch it again, I probably would put it up at number two. This is, like I said, this is a film that you could sit there and just be like, yeah, this is exactly the kind of douchebag that we thought Mark Zuckerberg was, and he still is to this mm-hmm. day. And I wouldn't be surprised if somebody decided...
Like, if you're surprised at anything that Facebook does to your information or anything like that, you obviously haven't seen social media social network, because if he's willing to do that kind of stuff to his friends, yeah, he doesn't care about you.
and to that point, I wouldn't be surprised if somebody tries to revisit this film and like does a 10-year gap with the exact same cast and try to see how it goes.
Oh yeah, give me a Social Network sequel.
Like, show me exactly what happened in 20. Give me what somebody was saying on a podcast I was listening to. Give me what happened in 2016 as a 10-year resurfacing. I would be so ready to watch that. Mm-hmm. The Social Network is arguably one of the best, I would say arguably one of the best films of the 2010s. If nobody has seen The Social Network, get your ass up and go watch it. Arguably one of the best films in the 2010s. David Fincher's top five movies, maybe top three. Mm-hmm. Don't waste any time. This is arguably the best film of the 2010s. And scary enough, like Johnny said, this was a prelude to how people look at social media and the internet almost a decade from now. So I hate to say it was a precursor, and it's scary enough that I'll probably watch it again, and it's going to remind me the exact same things that we were worried about in 2010 that is going on right now in 2019.
Yep.
So I completely understand. I was like, if he probably has Social Network at number three, number two, or number one, and I figured you'd have it at number one. So I figured. But that is our list of the top 10 films of the decade. Did you like it? Did you not like it? Definitely. If you have any comments, questions, concerns, our email, our Twitter.
Let us know.
Right. Our Twitter handle's on there. What I'm most likely going to do after the podcast is write down a full thread of my top 10 list. So if you have questions, definitely come hit us up. We will definitely talk about it. Now, before we go, I was going to ask, I know Christmas is next week. Do you want to do
Rise of Skywalker
before then? I'm watching it Friday at 1:30 in the morning.
I'm totally down.
Okay. Because that's that will be probably our last podcast of 2019.
Yeah, and then we'll have to come back with, I guess, our top films of 2019.
So, yeah, I guess, yeah, next week you'll probably see a special episode for Star Wars. No, not probably. You will see an episode of Star Wars, The Rise of Skywalker, and our deep dive in it. Will it be as long as this one? Probably, maybe. Maybe.
We'll see.
We're huge Star Wars fans, so we'll see how it goes. Speaking of which, can we tie that with Mandalorian?
Yeah, I guess by the time we record that Mando, the penultimate would have happened this week. Yeah. So there will be one episode left.
But there's something I want to discuss with you about Chapter 6 that happened that I think is going to come into play in Rise of Skywalker. But again, we can't talk about that right yet.
But yeah, we'll talk about it.
To that point, Johnny, where can the kids find you?
All right, you can find me on Instagram and Twitter at Johnny the Wonder, and you can find my Letterboxd reviews and lists and stuff at Johnny Boy Wonder on Letterboxd. And yourself?
You can find me at Instagram and Twitter at The King Julian Owens. I decided not to let my Letterboxd in next year. I might do that so you can see my list and my stars. I don't do reviews as much as Johnny, but definitely go check out Johnny's Letterboxd to see all of that. But that is all the time for us, guys. Thank you for sitting out, listening to us for over an hour. And we'll catch you guys the next time.
Later.